Good evening. Welcome to the Celeria Report. Today is July 27th. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and this is the fourth of our four-part rollout of the second quarter wrap-up. This one, the equity overview. And I refer you to two documents, the charts that are the financial charts in our web presentation section, as well as the wonderful blockbuster Chartology provided from Rambus. You can link to both of those in the subscriber links. I want to start off just by giving you a roundup of markets. And first I should say I'm in New York today. So if you hear the city noises in the background, you can certainly tell I'm in New York. Let's just walk quickly through the markets. Let's start with fixed income. The US dollar now down for the year at 8%. It's been trading 93, 94, 95. It hasn't broken that critical 92 line. It's one to keep an eye on. The long treasury, after yields started to rise in the beginning of the year, the sort of pressure is off, even though the Fed has been bumping rates. If you look at a variety of different factors in the market, rates, yields have come back down again. So the long treasury doing reasonably well at 4.68% return for the year. That's the 20-year ETF. The intermediate ETF up 2.65%. The bond aggregate up 2.65% and junk up 5.64%. Very nice performance from the high yield market. Equities have done much better than we expected. We're now 8.5 years into the bull market coming out of the bailouts, and the equity markets have certainly performed. S&P up 11.6% for the year. The home builders outperforming the S&P at 14.96%. Real estate underperforming at 7.03%. There's real concern about hollowing out of a variety of different kinds of commercial real estate. VGK, the European ETF, is up 20%. So almost double the U.S. performance. Clearly, when Macron won in France, a real sigh of relief for Europe and the European Union. Now the developed markets outside of North America up 17% and Germany up 17.66%. China doing very well with the small caps up 20.41% and the large caps up 22.6%. Emerging markets strongest of all with up 25.6% and India flying at 28%. Gold and silver have backed off a little bit, but they're up respectively 9.3% for gold, 3.8% for silver. Oil clearly in the doghouse, down 18.6%. That's a lot better than it's looked recently. And again, these prices are as the close today. If you look at the charts at the web presentation, they're exactly the second quarter at the end of June 30. So I'm just talking about current today. And again, in the last 2 weeks, we've hit new highs on the Dow and the S&P. The biggest returns during this period was not in the equity or fixed income markets, but in cryptocurrencies. It's been a very wild ride, with Bitcoin flying up to 3,000, then down to 2,000, then back up to 2,500 more. Ethereum also big gains and big swings. We've seen massive fraud and losses with various sites getting hacked and various serious problems in what is a very immature infrastructure. And finally, we saw this week the SEC come out and say that securities laws may apply to token offerings. That's a big change. And my guess is whether it's the SEC, other financial regulators, or the IRS coming out, the wild ride is going to continue, including the regulatory aspects of cryptocurrencies. Wouldn't surprise me to see the massive gains and losses continue for the rest of 2017, but expect the government to keep stepping in a way that makes things messier. I want to take a look at the big picture on the equity markets. This is something I've consistently come back and looked at over the last few years. It started with our discussion of Planet Equity in both the 2013 and 14 annual wrap-ups. I believe that we're shifting to an equity model planet-wide, and equity markets are going to continue to grow. This is an integral part of both globalization and becoming a multi-planetary civilization. If you are interested, I would suggest, particularly new subscribers, go back and check out the annual wrap-up since 2013. In 2013 and 2014, we talked about planet equity and as part of the globalization process, and then focused on space in the annual wrap-up 2015, published in January 2016. And then did the third quarter that year on the Chinese stock market, or the third quarter 2015. And then in the third quarter 2016, looked very hard at the screening industry. And then, of course, the annual wrap-up for 2016 that we did in January focused on what the or included a lot on what food has meant in the equity markets and why that might be changing. And of course, each wrap-up has a review of the financial charts for that quarter or year to date. And remember, I also post charts that I track every Sunday on the website. Now you have to log in to see them, but there should be, if you go back through the wrap-ups, there should be an extraordinary amount of information to help you sort of track what we're saying about planet equity and the big picture on the equity markets. To give you an overview, statistically, in 1990, the global equity markets were about 11 trillion. China was $0 of that. The Chinese markets reopened right in 1990. So they were 0% of that 11 trillion. Today, the global equity markets are approximately 70 to 80 trillion. The U.S. being about 27 trillion of that, China now 8 trillion, which is about 10% of the global float. If you look at China's growth since 1990, that is quite remarkable. And of course, if you want to include Hong Kong, you're talking about all of China representing 11 to 12 trillion. And if you look at the growth rate in Asia, both of companies going public in the both the subcontinent and East Asia, that's where a lot of the growth is coming. It's really important when you step back and look at the global equity markets to realize that Asia is converging with the G7 in terms of per capita income, but the emerging markets are not. And so there are two stories in the emerging markets. One, in Asia, where per capita incomes are growing and are expected to converge with G7, and the rest of the emerging markets where they're not. So that's one of the reasons why the rising Asian consumer is such a powerful primary trend. And if you haven't spent any time in Asia, I really constantly try and encourage people in my network to just get up and go, because you have to see it to understand how dynamic it is. Since the WTO in 1995 kicked off this amazing round of globalization that we've experienced over the last 20 plus years, we have had some very significant, massive money movements, many of which are not part of the official reality. And I want to go through them again, because it's very important when you look at the equity markets that you understand some of the money flows that have probably or certainly impacted them. One, of course, which I talk a lot about, including in the second quarter wrap-up, is the financial coup d'etat. There's been a massive transfer of money out of governments and central banks that has been engineering money into, or assets into, stocks and corporations. Of course, it's very hard to get accurate information. We can only guess and estimate, but from everything I've been able to see and document, we're talking about very significant shifts. A lot of that money, in my opinion, is poured into corporate securities or government securities that have been used to bubble corporate profits. So let me give you an idea of some of these things. Of course, we have the U.S. bailouts, over $20 trillion plus of gifts or loans. Again, the accounting is very murky. We've had massive federal Fed Central Bank, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, quantitative easing, bond purchases, and central bank stock purchases around the country, around the globe. Then in the United States, we have the missing money. I recently put up a new commentary documenting the undocumentable adjustments in DOD and HUD up to $11 trillion. And tomorrow or this weekend, we'll be putting up a second commentary, thanks to Dr. Mark Skidmore and his team at Michigan State University. They found several trillion more at various parts of DOD as well. So it looks like we're up to approximately $14 trillion. The question, of course, is how much is that in terms of cash or hard assets? And, of course, where did it go? I happen to believe it's very significant, and I think a lot of it went in places that ultimately ended up impacting corporate earnings, if not corporate stocks. Finally, or next, there's the Iraq War and wars in the Middle East. We've had tremendous reports of padding contracts, pallets of money, just $6 trillion on the Iraqi war, much of it going again to corporate contracts, corporate purchases. Then we have, and we've covered this in the past wrap-ups, we have sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, and the exchange stabilization fund buying significant amount of equity. So we're talking about many different governmental equities that manage, or entities that manage pools of assets all around the world, showing a very strong preference for investing in equities over the last 5 to 10 years. If you haven't listened to the Exchange Stabilization Fund interview with Rob Kirby, we did that this year in the hopes that that would help understand better some of the hidden system of finance that Dr. Farrell and I talk about. Add to these pools of money, we have derivatives. Again, with Rob Kirby, we did an interview on interest rate swaps and the extent to which interest rate swaps have been used to bring down interest rates. What that has done has made it easier to issue far more sovereign government bonds, again, flowing into corporate purchases and contracts. And then, of course, corporate bonds, financing stock buybacks, and other reengineerings into the equity markets. Add to this the explosion of sovereign bonds, both in the G7 world as well as in the emerging markets, again, financing government contracts and purchases, pumping corporate earnings. And so it goes on and on. And if you go back and look at all these sources, whether it's the bailouts, whether it's the Fed and central banking quantitative easing or stock purchases, the missing money, the war and hidden subsidies through war, the investment policies of government entities, including the sovereign wealth funds, the pension funds or covert funds like the ESF, and then the contribution of derivatives in both the fixed income market and equity markets, and how all of this rolled into money which supported both the income statements and revenues of corporations or the PEs by purchases of equities. We again are talking about massive shifts of money that have ballooned the corporate world and ballooned the equity markets. So let me give you two other examples that we see right in front of us right now in the market. One, healthcare. I think the reason the Republicans can't repeal Obamacare, among other reasons, is it would hit the healthcare stocks way too hard. Healthcare has been a big component of leading the U.S. stock market up, and healthcare, which was sort of down on the election last year, has recovered nicely this year. And I'm thinking that a lot of pressure is being brought to bear by existing institutions that don't want to see those healthcare stocks drop. The other is, of course, defense. We talked a lot coming into the election about the dependency of the markets on the military-industrial machine. Since 9/11, which to me clearly was a false flag, we've seen a bogus war on terrorism used to justify massive government contracts and into corporations and big purchases from things that really are they facilitate central control, and they create an endless flow of pork, but they're really they're unnecessary. And the ultimate sort of example of this is the latest to-do over the defense budget, with Trump suggesting we increase the defense budget by $50 billion, and McCain coming back with an increase of $109 billion. No one proposing a reinvention, whether of our role in the world or of the military. And it's exactly what Colonel Wilkerson had warned. If you go back and read my article, Productivity Backlash, I end with a great quote from Wilkerson, who talks about whether any candidate can stop this machinery, because it's literally run away with the U.S. budget. It wouldn't surprise me if it's the defense establishment now pushing for sanctions on the Russians and Iran, literally starting World War III. And I'm afraid that one of the reasons we're seeing such a terrible fight over the budget is literally you now have a very serious win-lose relationship between the basic needs of the general population and using the federal budget instead to keep the stock market up. Remember, capital gains from equity and real estate is a primary source of political campaign contributions, and that's part of the vicious cycle we're watching. Let me talk about some of the charts I find most interesting to help understand the current equity markets. I think if there's one chart that captures the dynamics that I'm talking about, it's one that was published by Fortune magazine in June 15th. It's not available online. I'm going to write Fortune and see if I can get permission to republish it. It shows the Fortune 500 revenues compared to the U.S. GDP from 1955 to 2017. And if you look from 1955 to 1995, so those 40 years, the GDP tracks almost perfectly with the GDP. Interestingly enough, the Fortune 500 revenues get a little bit of a bump during the 80s when the Iran-Contra and SNL frauds are hot and heavy, so a little fraud bump. And then in 1995, exactly when the WTO is implemented and the financial coup begins in fiscal 1988, we see the Fortune 500 revenues grow and literally take off. And sure enough, for the period 55 to 2017, the Fortune 500 revenues, as a result of that tremendous growth from 1995 on, have grown 8,713%, whereas the GDP has simply grown 400 and 648%. So suddenly, thanks to all the growth from 95 to 2017, the Fortune 500 revenues are growing twice as fast. And what that shows you is a tremendous centralization of economic flows into the Fortune 500. Some of that, of course, is globalization, but some of that is all the different centralization we've been talking about. And I believe a great deal of this has been facilitated by the financial coup d'etat and the financial flows I just listed. Let me read to you what Fortune says about this. For its first four decades, the Fortune 500 grew at about the same pace as U.S. GDP. That changed abruptly around 1995, when the list expanded beyond the industrial sector and the 500 rocketed ahead. The breakneck growth of tech companies such as Apple and Amazon help explain the acceleration. So does globalization. Americans' largest companies were simply better positioned than mom and pops to expand their businesses abroad. As a result, the Fortune 500 slice of the overall economy has grown fatter. The $12.1 trillion in total sales for this year's list equals 65% of U.S. GDP, up from 59% in 1995. This was certainly beyond the ken of our fortune forebears, who put the debut of the list on the cover of the July 1955 issue, right, almost as an afterthought. But even as it changes, the 500 remains, as we put it back then, a unique and distinguished roster. Okay, well, that's their official explanation of what happened. I think what happened is very different than they do. Anyway, when you look at this chart, of course, the big question for me is, how can this possibly be sustained? And the reality is it can't. This kind of divergence cannot possibly be sustained, although certainly going to a totalitarian society will keep it going for some period of time, or engaging in World War III might keep it going for some period of time. But if you look at the games that are going to have to be played to keep this going, there's simply not something that I want to see happen. What's interesting is if you look sort of at the 2016-17 period, you start to see the Fortune 500 revenues drop, which very much fits with the Economist story about multinationals in retreat, and multinationals, big Fortune 500 companies taking on much more local competition all around the world. So I think this is a very important chart, and it's one of the charts that most impacts my thinking on fundamentals. Another chart that's very useful is the Fed balance sheet. If you just do a search on the internet and do a search for Fed balance sheet versus the S&P, what you'll see is as the Fed's balance sheet is expanded, and I would include the ECB in that. So as the Fed and the ECB are buying bonds, sure enough, it's pumping money in that flows into the equity markets ultimately. And there's a clear correlation between ballooning the Fed balance sheet and pumping up the S&P or the equity markets. There's no way to chart the missing money versus the S&P, but I think if you look at the amount of undocumentable adjustments that are happening at DOD and HUD, again, you can look at the current commentary of the supporting documentation for the undocumentable adjustments, but I would encourage you to also look at the one we put up tomorrow this weekend. Again, that's $14 trillion flowing out between October 1997 and to date, and I happen to believe that that has had a tremendous impact on the equity markets. Part of my thinking is affected by the fact that when it started to flow out, you suddenly saw a series of sort of insider investment firms, including LBO firms and companies like Enron, experiencing this huge flow of investment capital or profits that was inexplicable, and no one could quite come up with an intelligent description of where it was coming from. So I think the connection is much tighter than most people dream. Okay, so one of the, finally, you've heard me talk a lot this year about the end of the debt growth model. And one of the reasons I believe this is not sustainable is you're really seeing the sovereign debt, which as governments have borrowed more and more money and use that to basically put money into corporations in a variety of ways, that sovereign debt growth is hitting a ceiling. Let me just give you some numbers. If you look at the debt to GDP ratio in the United States, when I first went into government under Bush Sr., it was 53.1% at the beginning of Bush 1. It was 66% when Bush left office. So it was 66% when Clinton came in, and then 65% when Clinton left. Now, that required a lot. The first term, it was 56% after the second term, but that required a lot of phony baloney bookkeeping on the budget. Then Bush 1 comes in at 56%, runs it up in two terms to 84%. That's wars in the Middle East. And then Obama comes in, and from 2009 to 2013, runs it up to 102%. I don't have the statistic on what it is today after the second term of Obama, but I bet it's higher. And so you're basically talking about going from a GDP, a debt to GDP of 50% to over 100%. And it's one of the reasons you're seeing so much tension around the budget. We see Trump coming in with an agenda to, quote unquote, make America great again. And the message from Congress consistently has been, we will not spend a dime on the general population. We need all of that money for basically holding up the stock market and keeping the game going. Okay, so let's step back and look at some fundamental analysis. I say the current trajectory is not sustainable for a couple reasons. First of all, we have peak everything. I talked about this after I went up to the mining conference in Canada in the first quarter. When you look at the mining companies, they're taking on more and more political risk and spending more and more money to mine for an ounce of gold or whatever they're going after. Their margins are clearly being squeezed by the fact that we have more and more people and we're using up the natural resources on this planet. It's not surprising that we see more stress on recycling and more stress on going into space and mining asteroids. And that's because the peak everything is squeezing the margins here. So that means a lot more work to get, the same amount of juice. The debt growth model is over. So we've tried to avoid we've tried to avoid the economics of peak everything by floating lots of debt. But as I said, we have an exhaustion of the sovereign debt game and the many tricks we've used to keep it going. So you add the debt growth model being over to peak everything, and then you're looking at a much harder environment. Okay, then add to that we are years overdue for a major correction. We have literally used the central bank like methadone to keep the steady rise of the stock market over the last 8.5 years. Maybe we've gotten at most a 10 to 12% correction. And so it's quite remarkable to see a market go without those kinds of consolidations, which are very, very healthy. I think another reason why that has happened is technology is increasingly deflationary. Clearly, the oil and gas sector has been hit hard by the oil prices and gas prices coming down. Now, that's been very helpful for the manufacturing, the industrial part of the sector, and it certainly helped the consumers. If it wasn't for lower gas prices, the consumers would be in a whole lot of hurt more than they are. But a perfect way of looking at the deflationary effect of technology can be seen when you look at the Whole Foods Amazon deal. Right after the deal was announced, Amazon went up by approximately $13 billion and the competitors went down by $40 billion. And so you saw a net loss of market cap of about $25 billion. And that's Amazon basically squeezing margins across the whole industry. So I expect, if anything, technology could be very deflationary. One of the symptoms that tells me the current trajectory is not sustainable is I'm seeing all sorts of quiet reports of high-end real estate soft or stalled around the country. And if that's the case, it's reflective of the cash flows being much tighter, including in the upper end, than they seem to be from simply watching the stock market. So you take all of those different factors, and what it says to me, the fundamental analysis indicates that this is not sustainable. Now, I say that, but there are some important variables to consider coming up in 2017. First of all, 90% of U.S. gains in the stock market come between November and June. So I think, if anything, the market's performing quite remarkably, given that we're in that sell in May and go away period of the summer. But it's clear the Trump administration is putting enormous stress on getting tax reform. And if they do, it could have a dramatic impact on cash flows into this country. If you get corporate repatriation, that money could flow back and do a variety of things that would be good for both the stock market and the country. In addition, if the Trump administration is successful in getting the estate tax canceled, you are going to see a major shift up in the U.S. becoming the premier safe haven location, and significant money flowing in from around the world, particularly from Asia. So I think both of those two could have a dramatic impact on capital flows coming into the United States. And so that could be very, very positive for continuing strength in the equity markets. A very big one, again, as I said, the balance sheet of the Fed correlates dramatically with the improvement in the equity markets over the last 8.5 years. So big question, the Fed is now saying that they're going to start shrinking their balance sheets starting in September. The ECB continues to buy it, but at some point they will end their purchases and may even follow along with the Fed. And so will that be the end of what money managers refer to as the Fed put? Basically, the Fed makes the stock market right and has continuously since the bailouts. And so this is a very Fed driven market. And so the question is, if the Fed starts to shrink the market, what could happen? And here, the other question, of course, if you look at what's been going on and what we talked about with what's causing the effort to preserve the unipolar world and the 7 countries in 5 year plan and war in the Middle East, the question is, does maintaining the Fed put in fact require World War III? I continue to believe the most dangerous aspect here to not just the stock market, but our lives, is that the continued push for war and for a unipolar world is killing a lot of global wealth. Needless to say, the sanctions, the Russian and Iran sanctions, have killed a lot of global wealth and continue to do. I think the game with migrants in Europe, ditto. If the U.S. pushes this too far, if anything, I think we could lose World War III. And so if you look at the things the leadership will do to keep the Fortune 500 revenues climbing at double the rate, they're going to become progressively more human. We saw, as an example, Eric Prince and Steve Feinberg, running the venture capital company that owns Steincore, make a proposal. This is so nuts, you don't even know what to think about it. Make a proposal that Afghanistan be turned over to basically a group of corporate mercenaries. Trump allowed them to go make a presentation to Mattis about the proposal instead of sending in additional U.S. troops. The idea is basically you take a country that you've broken and now turn it over to a group of corporations, but really mercenaries to run. The theory being it was the old East India model. And it's a perfect example of how ineffective the U.S. establishment has become. And again, it's a reminder of Colin Powell's warning, you break it, you own it. But if you look at what it's going to take to keep this model going, my problem is not only that it's terribly destructive, but I don't believe it will work. So, which is to say, if you review all the different issues on fundamental analysis, we have a few coming up with tax reform, which could be very bullish for the markets. But I would say, if you take all of them together, you're looking at increasing amount of risk to keep the game going. Now, I say that, and I would encourage you to take a look at the magnificent job Rambis has done of showing the charts. And what it shows is something commensurate with a market that's been very richly subsidized by all the different factors that we've talked about, but massive money shifting in. And it shows charts that very much argue, Rambis makes a very compelling case for an equity bull market, one that can last much longer. And that fits with a fundamental move away from government and towards the corporate sector. It also is supported by the notion that we're going to need central bank inflation to keep the debt managed. The central banks, if you look at what they've done with interest rates and with the sovereign or the growth of sovereign debt, they literally need continued inflation to keep the capital structure of the global governments simply functioning. And that kind of inflation can keep a bull market in the equity markets going for quite a while. In fact, what you're basically seeing is hyperinflation through the balance sheets. And of course, finally, I believe that globalization will continue, and it will continue in Asia, where tremendous growth in the number of companies accessing the equity markets and the growth, long-term rise of the Asian consumer can also drive, very much drive, an equity bull. So if, again, if you look at the technical analysis, there is a very strong case to be made for an equity bull market. And the challenge for all of us is the big question mark that hangs over it. Those charts reflect massive shifts from 1995 of government money and sort of non-sustainable flows. And of course, if they stop or come off and the thing corrects back to the mean, so Fortune 500 revenues come back in line with the GDP, we're talking, given the amount of subsidy that's flown in, we're talking about a major correction. And of course, anybody who lived through 2008 is not interested in another 35 or 50% down. So, so what do you do? Because you're sitting here looking at something that where every technical signal says long-term bull market, but we all know if you look underneath the rug, you've got some major risk issues going on. And in fact, if you look at what the leadership is doing to keep it going, you almost wish it would fail. You know, the human thing is to let it consolidate back where we can get back to some kind of fundamental economics. So let me talk about what this means to what I'm doing and what you may want to consider. The best returns I'm seeing across the board, whether through clients or subscribers or people who have their own companies, they've found a niche, they're good at doing it, they're doing something useful. And of course, if you can do that as an entrepreneur, it's the best thing possible. When it comes to liquid investments, the focus is clearly on equities and hard assets, staying in real things because the pressure to inflate is very, very real. And of course, technology is important, and new technology is going to have a very important impact. So I'm always looking for companies that are good at handling that shift from what I call global 2.0 to 3.0. I'm interested in solid companies with good dividends. This is an environment where dividends matter, even though we're in very low yields. You want to get paid for the use of your capital. So I'm much more interested in companies with dividends and companies that can pay those dividends in good times and bad. It's one of the reasons I wanted to look at food, because food relatively has an inelastic demand. And again, I would encourage you to go back if you haven't read the annual wrap-up that we published in January on the global harvest. I always like to hold cash back, and I think the chances of a major down, major correction, either this year or in 2018 are very real, particularly given the politics, and I want to make sure I have a cash for that. And I don't mind giving up yield to do that. I'm using managers in my practice who either use hedged equity, which means they're writing puts and putting a hedge on so that if we get a major drop in the market, there's a real floor underneath their positions. That means you give up percentage on the upside. So if you were in hedged equity this year, you've underperformed the folks who didn't have any hedges, who were just long because the market's gone up, up, up. But I'd rather give up percentage on the upside and avoid a major down. Because that means that in a major down, you can sell those hedges and buy stock cheap. And it's a way to have cash at the most propitious time to have it. The other managers I use are ones who are prepared to pull out quickly when things turn and they know how to do it. The other thing I'm doing is I'm steadily reducing my investment advisory practice so I can focus on the Solera report and on doing a screen. If you read the third quarter report last year, where we talk about can we screen for productive companies, I've launched a Solera World screen working with a money manager, and we've launched it, but we won't announce. I'll announce the screen sometime this fall or winter after Solera has launched our new website, and we're also doing a new website for Solera Advisor. So we're operating now, but quietly, and I want to spend a lot more time on that because I think there's tremendous need for real screens in what's called the ESG world. Environmental, social, and governance is what ESG stands for. There are many socially responsible screens and investment vehicles. I've never seen one that I thought used reality when it came to dealing with social responsibility. So my focus is on screening out any company who intentionally uses a model I would describe as organized crime or highly unethical. So I'm trying to get the criminals screened out, and I've rarely seen a socially responsible investment screen that screened the real criminals out. You know, it's basically based on the official reality, not on reality, and it's time we had screens that were based on reality. One of the areas that I think is going to outperform, as you know, is space companies involved in doing things in space. And it's one of the reasons in the second quarter wrap-up that we updated our list of space companies that we had in the 2015 annual wrap-up, Space Here We Go. So I'm going to keep researching those companies and trying to see what companies are going public in that area. We've divided them between companies traded in the U.S., in Europe, and the Asian markets. And if you look at the size and growth of the Asian space race, I think that's going to continue to grow. So check out those lists if you're interested. Key items to watch now for the rest of 2017 is number one, will we get tax reform, and will that include corporate tax repatriation and taking off the estate tax? You know, estate tax is an issue that's very important to many retiring boomers in this country, but it's really an international issue if you look at how the politics of this are playing. So number one, tax reform. Number two, will the Fed start to downsize their portfolio in September, really? And what will that mean to the equity markets? And finally, will the U.S. dollar index break the 92 line? I think those are three things to watch for the rest of the year, and they could have a dramatic impact on what happens to the market between now and the end of the year and next year. But again, I'm a big chicken, so no matter which way they go, I'd rather give some up on the upside and stay hedged. And of course, the other thing very important to me is to screen out the criminals. I don't want to be financing the people who are killing me. Okay, Ask Catherine. I wanted to take one Ask Catherine question because it very much related to the markets. Hi, Catherine. I've been a subscriber for a few months and have been doing my best to follow along. My head is spinning, I must say. I figured out the game via the ex-politics studying I was doing after I became friends with an ET contactee. I know, sounds crazy, but this is my life. I'm really concerned about what to do with the RRSP portfolio. That's the equivalent of the 401k in the United States. Can you recommend a good Canadian advisor or one who knows the Canadian market to give specific advice for my scenario? I don't trust my bankers anymore. I had a look at my last statement and saw the quotes. Investors were cautious as they waited for direction regarding how protectionist policies out of the U.S., such as Buy American, would impact Canada. Another classic was France elected a pro-Europe president, which eased concerns about the strength of the European Union. The U.S. Federal Reserve increased its federal funds rate as job gains remained solid. I don't trust the official stats out of the U.S., and I'm definitely not a Macron or Federal Reserve fan. It's hard to know where to go to get good blinders off advice for Canadians. Any idea? Is there a potential career opportunity in the longer term for me by chance? There seems a huge deficit of aware investment advice in Canada. I have to tell you, I don't know anybody in Canada who, and there are very, very few people I know on the whole planet who have tried to integrate full overt and covert economics and look at that in the context of what it means to smart financial planning and investment. So it's definitely a career opportunity. We very much need investment advisors and financial planners who understand the real deal. So I would encourage you to take a serious look at that. Okay, well, that's it for the second quarter equity overview. In summary, we have every indication of an ongoing major bull market in the equity markets, but it's got a very big question mark hanging over it because there has been such massive government and central bank support, not just on the overt side, but the covert side. Massive covert support that many market participants don't really understand, and of course, which it's impossible to get reliable statistics on. And the challenge we have is if that covert support should stop or reverse, you could get remarkably significant swings in this market. And so even though the every indication of volatility is very low, we know if it turns and turn hard, it could be a very big swing. And of course, that's what we all have to understand and have a strategy to deal with. So again, the charts say we're in a bull equity market and the bull is far from over. But the reality is there's a lot happening under the rug, and that puts a very big question mark over the market and makes me someone who continues to be very conservative and cautious. So that's it for the second quarter. I will be talking with you for the equity overview for the third quarter in October. And as I always do when I talk about the markets, I wish you good luck and good hunting.